Officially welcome everyone to today's CLUIN seminar. My name is Jean Valance and I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, where I'll be serving as your online moderator. For today's broadcast of CEC training for OSCs, which will look at RCRA for our on-scene coordinators, and that has been sponsored by the EPA Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. Our session today is going to run from approximately 1 to 3 p.m. Eastern. And before we kick off the technical portion of today's broadcast and I turn things over to our speaker today, I'm going to cover a few housekeeping and reminder items for our broadcast. So again, a welcome to the nearly 60 individuals who have joined us from across the country. For those of you that are just hopping on the line or just starting to get situated, I'm going to remind you to refer back to something called your registration or reminder email, which had a complete set of instructions on how you could join us for today's live broadcast. That email would have pointed you to something called the seminar homepage, which has a description of the event, contact information and bios for our presenters, links to download the presentation materials in a few different formats, options to provide feedback as well, but most importantly, a big button in the upper left corner that says Go to Seminar. If you click that button, it'll ask you to identify yourself, the number of people at your location, and then it'll bring you to our live interactive Adobe Connect environment. We'll be using this live tool so that our participants can actually sit back and listen and watch as our presenters move through the materials live and in real time. You'll actually be able to listen to the entire broadcast right through Adobe Connect using your computer or mobile device. If you have problems or are unable to join us online from Adobe Connect, you can simply call in and download a copy of the presentation materials, but you may miss out on some of the more interactive components of the broadcast. So we would encourage you to try to join us in the online session and just send me an email and report any technical problems that you might be having so I can try to troubleshoot those. By default, audio is available online through the Adobe Connect environment, which you can participate on from any device with internet access, whether it's a laptop, computer, or even a tablet or mobile telephone. That online audio can be controlled using a little speaker icon you should see in the top portion of your screen. It should be clicked and shaded bright green. If you're having any problems with the online audio, though, you may need to check your local speaker settings. Sometimes simply boosting your speaker output will fix the problem. If that doesn't work, though, we do have toll-free call-in information I'll be more than happy to give to anyone who needs it. Simply type a message in the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen, and I can give you the call-in number. If you are joining us on the telephone lines, please know you will be globally muted, and we ask that you remain globally muted to help cut down on any other background noises or other audio disruptions. We will take some breaks at designated points today for Q&A with our presenter. At that point, we will start reading through questions and comments so that he can address them. But I'm going to ask that you start typing up those questions and comments at any time. Some of you have already practiced this, so if you're new to it and have never done it before, go ahead and take a moment right now and look at the Q&A box or window that you see in the lower right corner. There's already a welcome message from me, Jean Valance. That's going to be the primary tool that you'll be using to submit your comments and questions. To type up a comment or question, simply click your cursor in the thin white field or box at the lower right corner at the very bottom of that Q&A window and start typing it up. It's a private submission form, so no one else will see your questions or comments. You can type up a test message. Just let me know how the visuals or audios are coming through. And again, that's the same thing that you're going to use to submit those comments and questions. There's no need to wait. Just start typing them up as soon as they occur to you. When we take our breaks, I will read them out loud on your behalf so that we can get an answer for you. Okay, today's session is being recorded, and you will automatically get an email as soon as that recorded version is available for free replay and download. You can certainly pass that on to anyone who needs it or thinks it will find this to be a valuable expenditure of their time. If you're looking for more seminars like this, we have 512, I believe, archived seminars that are currently available for free replay and download from the CLUIN website. Again, a brief reminder, you're going to look at the PowerPoint presentation. It's occupying the majority of your screen right here. If you're having any problems viewing that, there's a big full screen button that you'll see in the upper right corner of that window. If you click that full screen button, that'll blow up the slides. If you want to make them smaller again so you can see all the other windows, simply click full screen again. To the right of that, you'll see our CLUIN logo. Just below that, a collection of related URLs. Those are actually interactive URLs. You can click on any one of them and press the Browse to button to open them up locally on your own computer. And then just below that, you'll see the Q&A window where you can privately submit your comments and questions and report technical problems at any time by typing them here and clicking that little cartoon bubble to the right. So I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's broadcast. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our primary presenter today. We're going to be joined by Mr. David Phillips of Tetra Tech, who is a chemical engineer and a regulatory analyst with more than 28 years of environmental consulting experience. He has primarily supported EPA and other federal departments and agencies, as well as state regulatory agencies, in their rulemakings, program analysis, developing policies and guidance, as well as in site assessment, permitting, inspections, and enforcement of regulations. Specifically, though, to our audience, Mr. Phillips has been a CERCLA Education Center instructor for various courses, including our Fundamentals of Superfund Waste Treatment, Transportation and Disposal, Preliminary Assessment, Site Inspection, Removal and Remedial Processes, and, of course, Remedial Design and Remedial Action courses. So I think that's enough of an introduction for Dave. I'm going to go ahead and ask Dave to take himself off of mute, and feel free to begin his presentation whenever he's ready.
Okay. Gene, is okay? Can you hear me well?
Yep, I can hear you well. Feel free to begin.
Okay, then. Welcome, everybody. If you were expecting Paul Perrenard, unfortunately, Paul is in the middle of dealing with the flooding there out in Region 8 on the Front Range, and so he was unable to participate in this presentation. So he could be listening to me for the next 2 hours, mostly. So. What we have here today is our course, RCRA for OSCs. We've done this presentation a couple of times via the webinar, but we also offer this to EPA OSCs at OSC Readiness. And this is a kind of a condensed version of our waste treatment, transportation, and disposal course that we offer periodically through the CERCLA Education Center. And so our focus today is on RCRA requirements that are generally applicable or relevant and appropriate to CERCLA on-site actions. And this focuses mostly on the removal actions that OSCs take part, but it's also relevant to RPMs in the remedial world as well. So the first part of this presentation we'll deal with is just a quick overview of RCRA for those of you who might be new to it, and why RCRA requirements are important to OSCs, RPMs, and other folks who are involved in cleanups using CERCLA authority. First, RCRA is the federal statute that defines what is a hazardous waste, and obviously would define what's not considered a hazardous waste. And many cleanups under CERCLA authority generate remediation wastes that are defined as RCRA hazardous, or will involve management of materials that are defined as RCRA hazardous waste. RCRA also is important because it establishes many times the majority of action-specific, applicable, or relevant appropriate requirements for on-site waste management. If you are sending hazardous waste off-site as part of your response action, and those wastes are defined as RCRA hazardous, RCRA will be applicable to all off-site waste management. More also important is that how you define whether these remediation wastes are RCRA hazardous or not is going to can affect your strategy as well as your costs for treating, storing, disposing of remediation waste generated during response actions. As a matter of fact, just yesterday I got a call from an OSC working on a removal response, and there's questions as to whether some sediments and some soils from a wood treater site were defined as RCRA hazardous, and if they were, how land disposal restrictions requirements would apply, and how this would affect costs and strategy, whether they were going to pursue on-site treatment or off-site treatment for the contaminated sediments and soils. So this is a fairly frequent question and law, obviously, that comes up. Now, RCRA was enacted back in 1976, and it focuses on improper management of solid and hazardous waste. If you look at the slide there, you can see some of the goals established by Congress. What we're mostly concerned with here today is I'm flipping to the next slide, is we're concerned with the Subtitle C regulations dealing with the Hazardous Waste Management Program, because those are the ones we're going to be investigating and explaining how they apply to the management of cleanup wastes at your site. Just a little background on the legal framework of RCRA. It amended the existing Solid Waste Disposal Act, so sometimes you'll see RCRA referred to as the Solid Waste Disposal Act. Since RCRA's enactment in 1976, there's been several major amendments to it. The most important one was the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984. That added a number of statutory provisions for which EPA developed implementing regulations. One of the most important ones, which we'll be talking about here today, is the land disposal restrictions. Those were added by the HSWA authorities back in 1984. You also see reference there to a Federal Facilities Compliance Act of 1992. That just made it clear that federal facilities are subject to RCRA requirements, just like any private sector facility. And then the RCRA program actually, RCRA law actually created three major regulatory programs. Subtitle D, which addresses solid waste, at least from the federal EPA standpoint, the focus has mostly been there on regulations for municipal solid waste landfills. Subtitle D regulations, solid waste regulations, are primarily the responsibility of states and sometimes municipal and county authorities. And so when we're dealing with non-RCRA hazardous wastes, you're generally going to be working with state regulations or in some cases even county or other local regulations regarding the management and disposal. And this would be for things like construction and debris waste, some other types of waste streams which we'll identify later that are excluded from the RCRA definition of hazardous waste. I mentioned earlier that the focus of this this seminar webinar is on hazardous waste regulations, and those were established via authority in Subtitle C of the RCRA law, and that's where our focus is going to be. RCRA also established a program to address leaking underground storage tanks. This is referred to or identified as Subtitle I of RCRA. So let's look a little more at Subtitle C. The authority which provides for establishing a hazardous waste regulatory program. But Subtitle C has numerous provisions in there, and they authorize EPA to issue regulations on three major areas: hazardous waste identification, hazardous waste management, and corrective action. And corrective action is basically the RCRA cleanup authority that applies to RCRA-regulated treatment, storage, and disposal facilities and facilities that operated at some point under what we call interim status, where they were operating without a Part B permit until a Part B permit was disposition on that Part B permit was made by EPA or the state. Now, the federal regulations implementing the RCRA program are found in Title 40 Code of Federal Regulations, Part 260 through 279, and we'll be referencing those regulations throughout this webinar. RCRA, although federal EPA established the regulations, the RCRA program is delegated. There's provisions in the law that allows RCRA, like other federal environmental laws, such as the Safe Drinking Water Act, to delegate authority for implementing the program to the states. The majority of states are authorized to implement RCRA requirements. I think there's only two states currently that are not authorized, Iowa, and I believe Alaska returned the RCRA program back to it. So Region 10 would be implementing it in Alaska. So oftentimes what you will see is you'll actually be referring to the state regulations. States, in order to obtain authorization, have to develop a regulatory program that is consistent with the federal requirements. Sometimes the states will have regulations that are broader in scope and more stringent than the federal EPAs, and so they'll be applicable to your remediation waste within that state. An example which we always use is California. California has a more stringent program than the federal EPAs. They identify waste streams as hazardous in the state of California that would not be defined as RCRA hazardous by federal EPA and the federal regulations. So if you're doing response actions in within California, you'll have additional waste streams that will be have to be managed as hazardous waste within that state. Be aware of that. Let's move on to the next slide there. And so we'll go ahead and get to the gist of this webinar. And the major things we want to talk about are hazardous waste determination. What is a hazardous waste? What's not a hazardous waste? And so that's going to be the focus of this module. Then the next module we're going to talk about are the land disposal restrictions requirements. And what are treatment standards? When are they applicable? How do you meet the treatment standards? The other major part of RCRA we'll talk about then are some of the special rules and policies that EPA has established for managing remediation wastes. And so these are obviously of importance in response actions. We'll talk about things such as corrective action management units, areas of contamination, temporary units, what they are, what the regulations are for those that govern those types of units, which were created for management of remediation waste. So those are the three major parts of RCRA that we're going to talk about during this webinar. And these are three areas of RCRA that are most commonly you will encounter during a cleanup response under CERCLA authority. So let's look at this first one, which is hazardous waste determination. And it's an issue that almost always has to be addressed during a CERCLA response. We always get questions are the soils considered a hazardous waste? Are contaminated sediments considered hazardous waste? If you're doing a cleanup job at a abandoned plating facility, are the residues in the vats RCRA hazardous? How do you go about determining this? The RCRA requirements for regulations for defining a hazardous waste are obviously a prerequisite for determining whether RCRA management regulations are applicable to those wastes. And RCRA management regulations, once you define something as a RCRA hazardous waste, RCRA management regulations, you may have heard of this before, but they're comprehensive, and they affect the management of the waste from when it's first produced, what we often refer to as the cradle. There are governing regulations regarding the management of that waste till it's ultimately disposed. So cradle to grave, comprehensive regulations with respect to those wastes that are defined as hazardous. I got my start in this program many years ago working for the RCRA Superfund hotline. As I like to tell folks, we used to answer about 300,000 questions a year. 60% of those questions dealt with whether something was considered or how was something defined as a RCRA hazardous waste. And if you look at the regulations, and we'll get more into the details of the regulations and how they are used to determine whether something's a RCRA hazardous waste, the basic regulatory process involves four steps. It first starts with determining whether a waste material is excluded from the definition of solid waste. If not, does it meet the regulatory definition of a solid waste? If it is a solid waste, has it been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste? If not, does the solid waste meet the regulatory definition of hazardous waste? So those are the four basic steps that the regulatory structure or framework lays out for determining whether a material is a hazardous waste. But we always tell folks, and this goes back to our days on the hotline, is before you start looking at the regulations to determine whether something's a hazardous waste, answer three questions first. What is it? Okay. How is it produced? And what are you doing with it? What are you going to do with it? How are you going to manage it? This is a takeaway message for the webinar here. Whenever you're trying to determine whether something's a RCRA hazardous waste, make sure you answer these three questions first. What is it? How was it produced? And what am I going to do with it? Once you've established answers to those questions or answered those three questions, then when you look through the regulatory steps that we're going to talk about, the four basic steps to determine whether something's a RCRA hazardous waste, you'll have a more conclusive answer. Because if you change how you're going to manage something or how the waste was produced changes, that can affect whether you define it as a solid waste or whether, if it's a solid waste, if it's defined under the regulations as a solid waste, whether it's a hazardous waste. So it's really important to answer those three questions first, because we can have situations where you have three piles of soil contaminated with benzene, all at the same concentration. But depending on how that benzene got into the soil, and more importantly, what you're going to do with that soil with that benzene in it. In one case, the soil with benzene may be defined as a hazardous waste under RCRA. In another case, it may not be. So RCRA can be really confusing that way, but you can help yourself if you answer those three questions first before you start going into the regulations and then trying to determine whether it's hazardous. The last thing I'd like to say with respect to the regulatory, the regulations defining solid waste and hazardous waste, which we'll talk about more here in just a few seconds, is like all regulatory programs, there are words and terms in the regulations that are specifically defined by RCRA or by EPA in the implementing regulations. So you'll see references to terms such as spent material, commercial chemical product, byproduct, scrap metal, excluded scrap metal. All these terms have been defined for purposes of the regulatory definitions of solid waste and hazardous waste. There's many more. I've just given a couple of examples there. So be careful when you see a reference to a term like spent material, or again, commercial chemical product. These have specific definitions in the RCRA regulations. They'll either be defined in 40 CFR 260, or they'll be defined in 40 CFR 261.1, or even 40 CFR 261.2. So there's a number of terms and words that have special meanings within in the context of defining whether materials meet the definition of solid waste and hazardous waste. Okay, as I mentioned before, there's this four-step process for defining whether materials meet the definition of hazardous waste. And the major regulations, as I mentioned before, we'll go through these, are the exclusions from the definition of solid waste, the definition of solid waste, exclusions from the definition of hazardous waste, and then the regulatory definition of hazardous waste. In addition, if something has been defined as a hazardous waste, the rules, the regulations provide for variances and rulemaking petitions. This is primarily afforded to industry, where industry could petition EPA to, say, delist a hazardous waste that had been listed by EPA, and they could provide conditions and criteria for why a particular waste that's generated at their facility, even though it has been listed as a hazardous waste by EPA, it should not be subject to RCRA hazardous waste management regulations. So there's avenues by which materials that have been defined as hazardous waste can be ruled upon by EPA or the states in some cases, and those wastes can exit the RCRA Subtitle C regulatory program. And sometimes this is used in the cleanup world. We'll talk more about that when we talk about contaminated soils and sediments and something called the contained in rule. So we'll get to that a little bit later. So say you have this material out there, and you're trying to determine whether it's a RCRA hazardous waste or not. The first thing is to answer those three questions. What is it? How is it produced, and what am I going to do with it? Knowing that, then we look at the regulations. The first thing we do is determine whether Congress or EPA has excluded that particular material from regulation under RCRA because it does not meet the definition, the regulatory definition of solid waste. If you were to look in 40 CFR 261.4A, you'll notice that there are a number of materials that are excluded from the RCRA definition of solid waste. And so these materials, albeit many of them can be quite toxic and nasty, but they're just not going to be subject to RCRA regulations because they've been excluded from the definition of solid waste. And this would include things such as domestic sewage, certain types of in-situ mining wastes, okay, like overburden, irrigation return flows, point source discharges that are subject to regulation under the Clean Water Act. The important thing to understand with these exclusions, however, is if you look at them in the regulations, there may be like a one sentence or one paragraph description of it. Oftentimes, that doesn't provide a real good understanding of the scope of that exclusion. And so what you'll need to do to fully understand these exclusions is to go back to where the original rulemaking occurred and examine the Federal Register, which contained that exclusion or that rulemaking. And that's where you'll get a discussion in the preamble to the Federal Register of what the scope of that exclusion is. It's also often reflected in EPA interpretive memos and other guidance that they may put out on that particular waste stream. So just bear in mind that if you're looking at the CFR and you see an exclusion for something like, for example, point source discharges under the Clean Water Act, that exclusion only really applies to the point at which the wastewater is actually discharged into the surface water. If the wastewater is being impounded and treated prior to that actual discharge point, it would be defined as a solid waste. But once it passes through the flume into the water, okay, into the surface water in which it's being discharged, then at that point it's no longer defined as a solid waste pursuant to RCRA. Now, continuing our process of determining whether something meets the definition of a hazardous waste, let's assume that the material you have is not covered by any of those exclusions from the definition of solid waste. Our next step would be to determine whether the material in question meets the regulatory definition of solid waste. And this is set forth in 40 CFR 261.2. If you look at this regulatory definition, you'll see that the rules define solid waste first as discarded materials. And then EPA further defines what discarded actually means. And they define discarded in several different ways. First one is an abandoned. The second one is where the material is recycled in certain ways. And this is probably the most complex part of the definition of solid waste. We could spend a whole day talking about how the regulations determine whether when something's recycled, is it a solid waste or not. I'll give you a couple of rules of thumb, and we'll go briefly through it, but I just want to make you aware that that can be one of the more confusing parts of determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not, is if you plan to recycle it. The third way materials can be defined as being discarded is if they meet the regulatory definition of inherently waste-like. And then the fourth one deals with military munitions. And we'll explain what that is in a few seconds. But let's look at the most common one. It's this discarded materials include materials that are abandoned. And by abandoned, what we mean is actually there's three ways EPA has defined abandoned. Material can be abandoned if it is disposed of. And this would include where you place the material in a landfill or surface impoundment, a waste pile, a land treatment unit, or it's going to be placed into an underground injection well. So whenever you're managed waste, The second case is a material is abandoned if it is burned or incinerated. And this includes burning in an incinerator, or you're going to burn it in like a thermal desorption unit. The third way materials can be discarded by virtue of being abandoned is where you're accumulating materials, okay, like you're accumulating contaminated soils in a roll-off box, or you're accumulating liquid waste in a tank with the intent to abandon it. So you're going to dispose of it, or you're going to send it off-site for incineration, or burning in a boiler industrial furnace. If your intent is to dispose of and you're accumulating it prior to it, then the materials, while they're being accumulated, meet the regulatory definition of solid waste. Okay, let me go back to the continue the discussion of recycled in certain ways. This is, well, I should ask right now, are there any questions on abandoned? That's pretty straightforward there. Now, when we get into recycling materials, that's where the RCRA regulations can be very confusing as to when certain materials, when they're recycled, when they meet the definition of solid waste, and when recycled, they are no longer considered solid waste. This has been a struggle that the agency's been trying to resolve since RCRA regulations were first established back in 1980. In 1985, the agency issued a rulemaking on what they called the redefinition of solid waste, and that's set up the primary regulatory framework for determining when materials, when they're recycled, they're considered solid waste or not solid waste. And essentially, a material is a solid waste if it is recycled by being used in one of the four manners. Used in a manner constituting disposal, that simply means it's going to be placed on the ground, or it's going to be incorporated into a product that's going to be placed on the ground. Okay. A material is also generally considered a solid waste if it's going to be burned for energy recovery, not its normal intended use. So, for example, if you had a spent solvent, and you were going to send it to a cement kiln for as a fuel for RCRA. Reclaimed. Certain materials, if they have to be reclaimed before they can be put back into, you know, productive reuse, or they're going to reclaim minerals or some other valuable commodity from the waste, while you would be accumulating that, for example, if you had a spent plating solution, it might have still have some gold or silver in it, but the gold and silver had to be extracted from it. That spent plating solution would still be considered a solid waste, even though you might decide to send it to somebody who tried to reclaim the gold and silver from it. There's a fourth criteria called speculative accumulation. That's not typically applicable to cleanups. That's more to active RCRA regulated facilities, and that's just to regulatory control so folks don't accumulate a bunch of waste and they tell the inspectors that, oh, our intent's to recycle it, but they're not actually engaging in any active recycling of those materials. There's certain conditions, if met, that allow the agency or the states to identify such materials that are quote, going to be recycled but aren't. To define them as a solid waste because the generator or the producer, the facility, is engaging in what we call speculative accumulation. But if you remember those basic four things, if a material is used in a manner constituting disposal, burned for energy recovery, or reclaimed, or speculatively accumulated, they're still going to typically be solid waste if they're recycled in that manner. Now, if materials are going to be recycled by being reused as a virgin product without being reclaimed, any sort of reclamation, so say again you're doing a cleanup at a plating shop and you find you have a drum of acetone, unused acetone at the site. Rather than disposing it, you find through a waste broker, somebody who can take it exactly as is and use it. And they're not going to burn it. They're not going to apply it to the land. Okay. Then that material, because it's going to be reused as a virgin product without any reclamation prior to its reuse, it would not be defined as a solid waste under the definition of solid waste in 261.2. So that's one example where a material, if it's going to be reused as a virgin product, no reclamation prior to its reuse, and it's not going to be, again, burned for energy recovery or used in a manner constituting disposal, it would not be defined as a solid waste. Another example where a material, if it's recycled, is not solid waste, if it's used or reused as an ingredient in a manufacturing process. Again, you'd have to know what the manufacturing process is. It can't be involved burning or necessarily being applied to the ground, okay, the end product. But if a material was going to be recycled in some way where it could be reused as an ingredient, again, without having to go undergo some sort of reclamation prior to its reuse, it may not be a solid waste under the regulations. A final one would be is where a material is recycled by being reused in a closed-loop process, industrial process. And there have been situations where we've encountered that at some sites. It gets more complex. You have to have a lot of documentation. You have to understand the process by which you know, this closed-loop process operates. But again, a material that's being reused in that particular process, again, may meet the criteria and no longer be defined as a solid waste for purposes of RCRA regulation. But as you can tell on these three criteria I just gave you there, you have to know a lot about the recycling operation or reuse operation, okay, to definitively state that such a material, when used and reused in that manner, recycled in that manner, does not meet the definition of solid waste. One of the other ways I mentioned materials can meet the definition of solid waste is if they meet this definition of inherently waste-like. This is a very small subset of pesticide waste streams or basically residual waste from the manufacturing of certain pesticides, which EPA has identified. They're actually listed hazardous waste. And the agency, for those small set of waste streams, the agency says, we don't care how you recycle them, we consider them to be inherently waste-like, and therefore they're going to remain a solid waste no matter what. And then with respect to military munitions, this is a rulemaking came out back in 1997. This deals with unexploded ordnance and munitions that the Department of Defense takes out of the active stockpile or arsenal for decommissioning. But there are special regulations, I believe, in subpart M of Part 266 that define when military munitions become solid wastes under RCRA. And so just be aware of that if you're doing cleanups at federal facilities or closed ranges, or you might be doing cleanups at formerly used defense sites where you encounter, again, potentially encounter something that may be defined as military munition. In the process here, we have our material. We've defined what it is, how it was produced, and how it's going to be managed. We first examine, is it excluded from the definition of solid waste? And we've determined that doesn't apply. Then we examined whether it met the regulatory definition of solid waste under 261.2, and we said, yes, the material does meet the regulatory definition of a solid waste. Before we can determine whether it's hazardous waste, now we have to determine whether it's been excluded by Congress or EPA from the regulatory definition of hazardous waste. And where you would look to examine that is in 40 CFR 261.4. There are several pages in the CFR that identify a whole host of waste streams, solid waste, that are not defined federally or excluded from the federal definition of hazardous waste. These things include household wastes, utility wastes, like coal ash, okay, or fly ash, bottom ash from coal-fired power plants, waste from the exploration, production, and development of crude oil, natural gas, and geothermal energy. So these would be waste streams at the drilling sites. Certain types of waste from the extraction, beneficiation, and processing of ores and minerals. This is, you'll hear this referred to as the Bell exclusion or the mining waste exclusion. A very complicated exclusion that, again, takes a bit of looking through. You have to know really specifically what your waste stream is, again, how it was produced, in order to determine whether or not it's going to fit into the Bevel exclusion, okay, or if it's not excluded. Cement kiln dust, but there's a whole list of items there, or waste streams, solid waste, that are excluded from the definition of RCRA hazardous waste. Again, I caution you that if you simply look at the CFR and read the paragraph or two that describes that exclusion, you probably aren't going to get a full understanding of the scope of that exclusion. And so you'll need to go back to the Federal Register, if it's applicable, if your site is addressing this type of waste stream, that you need to go back to the Federal Register where these exclusions were drafted and clarified by the agency, and read the preamble to get a full understanding of the scope of that particular exclusion. Okay. So let's continue that. We'll assume that the waste stream that your solid waste that you're examining is not covered by one of those exclusions. What happens next? Well, then we finally get to the regulatory definition of hazardous waste. And that's in 40 CFR 261.3. And that includes solid wastes that are listed by EPA, exhibit any of the four characteristics of hazardous waste, which we call the characteristics or characteristic hazardous wastes, is a mixture of solid waste and a listed hazardous waste. This is also referred to as the mixture rule. Or it's a solid waste that has been derived from treating, storing, or disposing of a hazardous waste, and this is what we refer to as the derived from rule. When Congress gave EPA authority to identify which solid waste or hazardous waste, they gave them two mechanisms. They can either go about listing, do a study on waste streams, and then via rulemaking, listing that waste as a hazardous waste. And so EPA has created four categories of listed hazardous wastes. And these are waste streams that are found in 40 CFR 261.31, .32, and .33. And you'll see them referred to as F wastes, K wastes, and then there's a number of what we call commercial chemical products that have been listed as hazardous waste when they're discarded or abandoned or thrown away. And these are denoted by the waste codes P and U. P simply meaning as a definition that the waste is acutely hazardous, so it becomes subject to regulation if you generate one kilogram or more per calendar month, versus the U wastes or non-acute hazardous wastes, which become subject to full RCRA regulation if you generate greater than 100 kilograms or 1,000 kilograms per month. So EPA, via rulemaking, has listed several hundred waste streams as hazardous. What's important to know there is where EPA has listed a hazardous waste is you simply need to, that's why you need to know how the waste was produced. Because if you know how the waste was produced, you look at the description that EPA has provided for a listed hazardous waste, and if it matches that description, then you're done. You've identified that the waste is hazardous. You don't have to do any sampling or analysis or testing. You see, all the waste stream needs to do is simply meet that description that EPA has provided for a listed hazardous waste. Meets it, then your solid waste is a hazardous waste under RCRA. So an example would be a spent solvent. Let's say you have that spent solvent, you use benzene. I know benzene in itself, it's rare to use a solvent nowadays, but it's kind of a simple one. Or you could have toluene. If you say you had toluene as a solvent at your plating shop, you were using it to degrease metals, okay, before you plated them. You have a solution of spent toluene, and you're going to discard it. You're throw it away. It's a solid waste because you're going to, it meets the definition of discarded material because you're abandoning it. It's not excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. If we were to look at 40 CFR 261.31, we would see that EPA has a listed hazardous waste, I believe it's F005, and it includes spent solvents containing toluene. So if I had an MSDS of that material, and I found that, and I had the drum there and it was labeled, I'd have all the information that's necessary to determine that that is a listed hazardous waste and subject to RCRA regulation. I wouldn't need to necessarily sample that or not. Now, the other mechanism for defining hazardous wastes is EPA has identified four characteristics or properties of hazardous waste. This includes ignitability, reactivity, corrosivity, and toxicity. So where a waste stream has not been listed by EPA, you need to determine whether it exhibits any of those characteristics. And if it exhibits any one of those characteristics, then your solid waste is defined as a hazardous waste under RCRA regulations. For ignitability, corrosivity, and toxicity, EPA has established test methods which can be used to determine whether or not the waste stream exhibits those properties. If you're the one who's making that determination, you can, or the generator of the waste, you can also use your professional knowledge. So if you have, say, again, a material safety data sheet that says that the solvent, say you have a mineral spirit, it's a petroleum-based solvent, so it's not listed as a hazardous waste, and ignitability, and you can see that one of the criteria in defining the ignitability characteristic is whether the waste stream exhibits a flash point less than 120 degrees Fahrenheit. You have information that shows that you meet that criteria, that's mineral spirits that you were throwing away would be considered a RCRA hazardous waste because it exhibits the characteristic. If I didn't have the MSDS, I could then take a sample of that mineral spirit. Okay, and there's a Penske-Martin's closed-cup tester, which is the test method which is used. And if I examined the flash point and determined that flash point, again, was below 120 degrees Fahrenheit, then the test method would indicate that that spent mineral or that mineral spirits that I was discarding meets the definition of ignitability and therefore is defined as a hazardous waste. So the characteristics, again, corrosivity, you're looking at pH, or in the case where something doesn't exhibit a pH, there's a National Association of Corrosion Engineers test, which is used to determine whether, a waste would exhibit the characteristic of corrosivity. And then there's the toxicity characteristic. And that's where you use a test method called the Toxicity Characteristic Leaching Procedure, or TCLP. And that test method examines waste streams to determine whether they have toxic metals or certain organic constituents that will leach from the waste stream at levels above which they would be a threat to contaminate drinking water. And therefore, they need to be managed in a RCRA hazardous waste landfill versus being disposed of in a municipal solid waste landfill. So the TCLP is the test method which is used, and EPA has established regulatory thresholds for about 39 or 40 constituents, metals, pesticides, and some other organics, where if you exceed those regulatory thresholds via the leaching test, then the waste stream is again defined as exhibiting characteristic of toxicity, and we need to be managed as a RCRA hazardous waste. The mixture and derived from rules basically were put in place to prevent people from, in one case, mixing solid waste and listed hazardous waste and trying to to argue that they were not subject to RCRA regulation. So the idea basically here is if you have a listed hazardous waste and you mix it with another waste, then the mixture is going to be considered a listed hazardous waste unless you prove otherwise. Similar is if you have a waste that's derived from the treatment, storage, or disposal of another hazardous waste, and the original waste was listed. So, for example, say you have some contaminated soils that have been identified as a listed hazardous waste, and then you treat them on site, and you have a treatment residue that comes from that. The treatment residue was derived from a listed hazardous waste. So that residue is still going to be considered a RCRA hazardous waste unless you delist it, okay, or if the waste was defined as hazardous because of the contained in rule, which we're going to talk about in a few slides, you got something called a contained out determination. So be aware of these mixture and derived from rules because they can come into play at your cleanup, you know, at CERCLA sites, depending on, again, how you're managing the waste streams. Okay. This slide here, listed hazardous waste, I talked about this a little bit before. These are just the different waste streams that have been listed by EPA. Waste from non-specific sources are denoted by F codes. The waste streams from specific sources are denoted by K codes. The K codes are very specific. If you look at 40 CFR 261.32, you'll see there. These are from specific industrial processes. Commercial chemical products. This is kind of unique in that you'll see that there are a bunch of specific chemical names, such as acetone, warfarin, benzene, all sorts of different chemicals. We're referring to basically the pure product and not a mixture of chemicals that may contain chemical, benzene or warfarin or something like that in the mixture, unless that ingredient is the sole active ingredient in the mixture. So those P and U coded waste, listed waste streams, really are talking about where we're discarding a technical grade or pure grade of that specific chemical, or a mixture containing that chemical where the chemical is considered the sole active ingredient, such as in a pesticide. One thing here in this next slide I want to make a point about with respect to CERCLA sites. Oftentimes you'll come to your site, you have a slew of different waste streams, and you have no idea how they were produced, particularly if it was a disposal or recycling facility that accepted a bunch of waste streams from various generators, and they don't have records there as to what the waste was or how it was produced. EPA issued a policy. It was described originally in the amendments to National Contingency Plan back in March 1990 in that Federal Register, but it basically said, you do not have to assume that a waste stream is a listed hazardous RCRA waste. So if you have a waste stream that, say, contains benzene in it, you don't have to assume that is a RCRA hazardous waste unless you have some sort of evidence, okay, or documentation that you can use to make that determination. So that's why if you don't know how something was produced, you don't have to assume it comes from a source that may have produced the listed hazardous waste. So that's why it's important to know where something comes from. If you do know that information, then that will help you determine potentially whether a solid waste is a listed hazardous waste. But in the absence of that, you don't have to assume anything if you don't have the evidence or you don't have some sort of definitive information that would indicate that the waste stream was a result of a process that is described in a listed hazardous waste stream by EPA. So I just want to make you aware of that. Okay, the next slide here deals with characteristics of hazardous waste. And we've talked about that, the four characteristics: ignitability, corrosivity, reactivity, and toxicity. Again, the important thing here is if a waste, solid waste, does not meet a listing, then you need to determine whether it exhibits any of these characteristics. Obviously, if the waste stream does not exhibit any of these characteristics, then it's not defined as hazardous waste under the RCRA regulatory program. Okay, I mentioned the legal, the mixture and derived from rules. Now let's move to this, the last tenet or that you should be aware of in determining whether something's a hazardous waste or not under RCRA. And this is what we call the contained in policy. And this addresses contaminated environmental media, such as soils, sediments, and groundwater at sites. You won't find the contained in policy in 40 CFR 261.2 or 261.3. There are not regulations, federal regulations, that define what we refer to, you'll hear referred to as contained in rule over the years. Actually, the agency was challenged in court over this interpretation, and they won. It is considered an AROR at CERCLA responses. So if you have contaminated environmental media, such as contaminated soils, the contained in policy needs to be considered. Now, what the contained in policy basically is, say you come upon a site where you have a bunch of contaminated soil as a result of a release of a hazardous waste from, say, a tank system or wood treater sites, a lot of the preservatives, like the creosote preservatives, which they use to treat wood. The creosote preservatives and the process residues from creosote treatment are listed hazardous wastes under RCRA, given the waste code F034. But if you look for contaminated soil, you'll notice that in RCRA, there is no listing for contaminated soil. So if you look at the F and K waste codes, there's no listing that covers contaminated soils. But under this policy, if we can make a determination that we know where that creosote came from, okay, and for example, we know that they spilled a bunch of the preservative onto soil as they were treating wood, and so we're cleaning up the soil and has high levels of PAHs, high levels of creosote in there. We can make a determination that soil needs to be managed as a RCRA hazardous waste because it, quote, contains F034. So that's an example of how the containing policy would work. A similar approach would be for contaminated sediments, or even for contaminated groundwater. For example, if you had a bunch of buried drums of spent TCE and those drums leaked and contaminated the surrounding soils and groundwater, and you excavated the soils to dispose of them off-site, the question would become, well, are those contaminated soils a RCRA hazardous waste, or should they be regulated or managed as a RCRA hazardous waste? And if we knew that the source of that TC in the soils was from a listed source, we could argue that, and the states will often do this in their they'll have a program, they'll sit there and say, no, that the soil contains a listed hazardous waste, and so you would have to manage it as, say, F002. Similar with the groundwater, if the TCE got into the groundwater, we knew it came from a source. When you extract that groundwater with the TCE, a determination could be made that it contains a listed hazardous waste. But again, this is based on knowing what the source is and determining that the source of the release was, in fact, a listed hazardous waste. Now, if you have contaminated sediments, contaminated soils, contaminated groundwater, and you can't definitively determine that the source is a listed RCRA hazardous waste, then those media would only be defined as hazardous if they exhibit any of the characteristics of hazardous waste. So they would have to exhibit most likely the characteristic of toxicity because they have, say, high levels of metal or high levels of the regulated organics or pesticides that are addressed by the toxicity characteristic. Now, you'll notice in my slide that we say that the containment policy lacks a definitive federal guidance. That's not the case. A number of states, many states have defined, have either issued guidance or policy or actually have issued regulations to define this contained in rule or contained in policy as it applies in their states. So be aware of that in your cleanups. A number of states, like Michigan, for example, I believe has them. There are several other states that have a definition of which is used to make a contained in determination, and something called a corresponding contained out determination, and it's embodied in the regulations or in guidance. And this may, you know, again, this can be an applicable or relevant appropriate requirement at a circle response that you need to consider. Okay, the last thing we have here is on variances and petitions. This is just where if you do have materials which are defined as RCRA-listed hazardous waste, or if you have contaminated media that contains a RCRA hazardous waste, there are avenues available through the EPA regional office or some in the state to obtain either delist the listed waste or obtain what they call a contained out determination. And the result of successfully obtaining one of these determinations is that the media or the waste that you're dealing with would be no longer subject to RCRA regulations. Again, the states oftentimes will have contained out determination criteria which are used. They'll have some sort of established numbers for soils or sediments, where if you're below those numbers, they will consider that sediment or soil to no longer contain a listed hazardous waste, and that will allow you to manage that contaminated soil or sediment as solid waste instead. So be aware of those determinations or those numbers that may exist in some states. They may be important to your cleanups.
Dave, before you go a little bit further, I just wanted to do a real quick time check. It's a little bit after 2 p.m.
Sure.
And we do have a few questions that have come in online. Would you mind if we just take a quick pause and go through some of these?
Sure, absolutely. I was just about ready to break for that. But go ahead, Jane.
Okay. The first question that we actually had came in reference to slide number 19. One of the participants wants to know, what was the EPA rule in 1990 that allows you not to assume an unknown waste is listed as haz?
It's not a rule. What it is it's in the preamble to the amendments to the National Contingency Plan. I believe it's in March of 1990. I can't recall the date off the top of my head. I'll have to look it up here. Second here, see if I can find it real quick for you. The difference between listed and characteristic wastes. And they mentioned that oftentimes at CERCLA sites, you don't know where the waste came from or who generated the waste or how it was generated. And they were just basically providing the RPM or the OSC with the discretion not to assume that this comes from a listed source, because a lot of times the waste streams or the remediation waste that you're dealing with may contain things like toluene, benzene, or other types of metals that are identified as listed hazardous waste. But if you don't have definitive evidence that that waste stream comes from a listed source, you don't need to assume that. So I would direct you to, again, that preamble language. It's also been discussed about in, I believe there's a 1998 memo on remediation waste that came out of the old Office of Solid Waste, Management of Remediation Waste. If you Google that, there's a reference to that as well. And that provided guidance for folks in the RCRA Corrective Action Program, but it's applicable to CERCLA responses as well, that kind of restates that guidance where you don't have to assume something is a waste is a listed waste unless you have that evidence or some sort of documentation when you're doing a response under CERCLA.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jane. You can read the next question.
The next question actually came in very early on, and this one just asks if the FFCA applies to lands that are held in trust by agencies like the Army Corps of Engineers and Fish and Wildlife Service.
I believe it only deals with federal facility, and federal facility is a defined term under maybe not necessarily where you're acting as a trustee in that case. I would have to double check that to be sure on that for you. But I think what they're looking there, the idea behind the Federal Facility Compliance Act was to address the implementation of RCRA regulations by EPA and by states, state authorized program, at active industrial operations, owned and operated by the federal government. So this would be like a Department of Defense installation or Department of Energy installation, where they would be generating waste streams. And prior to the FFCA, there were occasions where, in particular, the Department of Energy would argue that state regulations didn't apply, state RCRA regulations didn't apply. And so that was what the FFCA attempted to clarify. The Department of Interior or the Corps is a...
Regarding laws on military munitions, and they'd like to know if the laws on military munitions apply to foreign munitions that are found on or in a non-military scenario.
Oh, that's a good question. When you're saying foreign munitions, I guess, if you look at the definition of military munitions, they talk about it in the context of the Department of Defense's determination, whether it's part of the active arsenal or not. So I don't think there's a discussion there on foreign munitions. I would go back to, I'm trying to think of an example where you would encounter foreign munitions. Is this where, we're receiving, say, chemical munitions from another country and we're destroying them under a treaty agreement? I don't know if the person who offered that question can clarify for me, because I'm trying to identify an example where foreign munitions, where that would possibly be an issue.
They actually have chimed in and commented that they found Russian artillery rounds in a backyard at one of their sites.
Wow.
So they wanted to know if they would be treating that as military munitions, even though it wasn't United States munitions.
I would argue that you're throwing it away, so if you're abandoning it, it's a solid waste. It may not meet the definition of military munition, but it's probably, if it's live, it's going to be reactive. And so I would manage it, I would consider it a hazardous waste.
Okay. We have another just clarifying statement. One of our participants wanted to note, when you're going through the characteristics, they stated that the ignitability characteristic flashpoint ceiling is actually 140 degrees Fahrenheit, not 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
They're correct.
I'm not sure if that's a typo. Okay.
They're correct. That's my fault. I apologize.
No problem. And then we do have another question that came online regarding the mixture rule. This participant would like to know if the mixture rule, does it apply if the waste is a solid waste and a characteristic waste, or does it apply only to listed waste mixtures?
Okay, that's a good question. I didn't go into detail on it because I'm already at 211 here. But, yeah, the mixture rule derived from rules. The rule of thumb, it's a little more nuanced and complicated than what I explained. Essentially, the way they work is if you mix a solid waste with a listed hazardous waste, and the basis of the listing is because EPA has to, when they list a hazardous waste, they have to describe why they listed it, and there's criteria that they have to meet in order to list a waste as hazardous. But one of the primary ways they do it is it contains a toxic constituent in it. So if something's been, solid waste has been mixed with a listed hazardous waste, and the basis for the listing is because it contains a toxic constituent in it, then the mixture rule states that that corresponding resulting mixture remains a listed hazardous waste. If you mix a solid waste with a hazardous waste that only exhibits the characteristic, or if it's listed, but it's only listed based on the fact that it exhibits a characteristic only, for example, a characteristic of ignitability, reactivity, then the resulting mixture remains a hazardous waste only if it continues to exhibit any of the characteristics. So in theory, yes, you could take a solid waste, mix it with a, say, a characteristic waste, a waste that exhibits only the ignitability, and as a result of mixing them together, the resulting mixture no longer exhibits any of the characteristics. Well, that resulting mixture would no longer be considered a hazardous waste, but the process of mixing the two would be defined as treatment under RCRA. The other issue you might have is that if the original characteristic waste was subject to the land disposal restrictions and did not meet treatment standards, which we're going to talk about in a few minutes, even though you mixed another waste with it, rendered it non-hazardous, you would still have to determine whether or not that resulting mixture met LDR treatment standards before you could land dispose of it, because it would be prohibited from land disposal.
Okay. It looks like the end of the online questions that got submitted, so we can carry on with the presentation. But for the participants, you guys can continue to submit your comments and questions, and we'll take another break later on in today's broadcast. And just a quick reminder, we're at 2:15 p.m. Eastern, and we are scheduled to close around 3 p.m. Eastern.
Okay. Well, that's a good prompt, Jean. That means I need to pick it up. But with RCRA, there's a lot to talk about here. So we have a lot of things to go through yet. But those are good questions, by the way. Excellent questions. And thank you for clarifying the flashpoint temperature. It is 140 degrees. And not 120, as I was saying earlier. I just want to also make you aware of an alternative regulatory program. Many of you may have heard of something called Universal Waste, and this is an alternative regulatory program that EPA has established. It addresses batteries, pesticides, mercury-containing equipment, and fluorescent lamps that would be defined as RCRA hazardous for one reason or another. Some states also include additional waste streams under their universal waste programs. They can include e-wastes, aerosol cans, certain types of paint wastes. Anyways, if you do encounter these wastes at your cleanup, you can manage them under the universal waste program, which is a less stringent program, provides you much more flexibility than managing them as under the RCRA hazardous waste regulatory program. So just be aware, if you have materials out there that meet this definition of universal waste, this provides you with a more flexible, less stringent alternative regulatory program for managing those particular waste streams. Okay, so we completed our discussion on the definition of hazardous waste. Again, final time I'll bring this up is make sure when you're trying to determine whether something's a hazardous waste under RCRA that you know what the material is, how it was produced, and what you're going to do with it. And then the steps are simply determine whether it's excluded from the definition of solid waste. If not, does it meet the regulatory definition of solid waste? If it is defined as a solid waste, has it been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste? If not, does the solid waste meet the definition of hazardous waste because first it is listed? If not listed, it exhibits any of the characteristics. Okay. If you're dealing with contaminated media, be aware of something called the Contained-In Rule or Contained-In Policy as well, because it can apply. It can result in and contaminated media being regulated as RCRA hazardous waste. Okay. The land disposal restrictions is a question, is a topic we often encounter too during cleanups. Now, the LDRs were established by the Hazardous and Solid Waste Amendments of 1984, and basically the purpose behind this was Congress wanted to ensure that any hazardous waste that were going to be land disposed would go through some form of treatment which would reduce the toxicity, mobility of toxic constituents, reduce the volume of the waste, make it safer before it was ultimately land disposed. And I like to think of it as almost like a pre-treatment program. Before you can put your hazardous waste in something that's defined as land disposal by the regulations, it has to be treated before it goes in there. Land disposal is broadly defined for the purposes of land disposal restrictions. It includes essentially placing the waste on the land. So if you're going to place waste directly on land in a waste pile, if you're going to put it into a surface impoundment, if you're going to dispose of it via underground injection, if you're going to put it into a landfill, if you're going to place the waste in a missile silo, an abandoned missile silo, and this has been done, that's defined as land disposal for purposes of the land disposal restrictions regulations under RCRA. Now, the land disposal restrictions attach. What we mean by this is you have to, as soon as you generate a hazardous waste at your cleanup, okay, if you generate something that's defined as a listed hazardous waste or a characteristic hazardous waste, okay, it becomes subject to land disposal restrictions. And so this idea of the LDRs is that the requirement to determine whether that waste is prohibited from land disposal commences at the point that you produce it. And if the waste is prohibited from land disposal, if it does not meet applicable land disposal restriction treatment standards, which we're going to talk about in a few seconds. And so you have to determine if that waste meets the treatment standards or does not meet the treatment standards. If it does not meet the treatment standards, then it's prohibited from disposal. And, okay, say you're going to send it to a reclamation facility. You would have to notify that reclamation facility that this is waste is prohibited from disposal. And so that would be your obligation. If your intent was to land disposal, obviously you would have to have it treated before it could ultimately FR Part 268. And the key regulations are determining whether something is a restricted waste or subject to the land disposal restrictions. The other thing is, if it is a subject to the land disposal restrictions, determining what treatment standards apply to that hazardous waste. And that's the crux to what we'll talk about in the next 15 minutes. Be aware that there are prohibitions against diluting wastes to meet these treatment standards. There is also a prohibition against storing waste subject to the land disposal restrictions as a method or means of avoiding complying with those treatment standards. And then from a cleanup standpoint, you want to be aware of that when you send hazardous waste off-site, okay, there are some requirements in addition to the manifest that you have to prepare with the initial shipment of that waste to the vendor that you're using. And those additional tracking requirements are associated with the LDRs, land disposal restrictions. And it's basically notifying the subsequent handler or the vendor who's your treatment, storage, and disposal facility as to whether the waste is prohibited from land disposal or not, and what the treatment standards are. And there's different forms that are used. So just be aware that if you're shipping waste off-site, hazardous waste off-site for disposal, you'll have these tracking requirements in addition to using a manifest, which is also required for off-site shipments of RCRA hazardous wastes. The final thing is there are some variances that are available for you to use, and they have been used in some cases in CERCLA cleanups, where you can get an alternative treatment standard versus an applicable treatment standard has been identified for your waste. And this is important because sometimes if you have a large volume of contaminated waste, RCRA hazardous waste that's subject to a treatment standard, it may be extraordinarily expensive to comply with that standard. And that may, as a result, you may choose not to actively treat that waste as a because of that expense. But if you can pursue an alternative treatment standard, which is a more less stringent standard, okay, and it can actually be a risk-based standard based on risk and not based on technology, which is the way all treatment standards are established by EPA. They're based on the performance of best demonstrated available technology. A more less stringent standard may result in reduced costs. It may result in more active treatment of waste that would otherwise occur versus you having to comply with the established treatment standard that was applicable to that waste. So there are these variances that exist out there, and they have been used on occasion. Unfortunately, we're not going to have a lot of time to go into that, but I just want to make you aware of those. Now, this first slide says identification of restricted waste. This is found in 40 CFR Part 268, Subpart C. First thing I want to say, though, and this is the most critical thing here, is the LDRs and this concept of treatment standards are only apply if what you have is a RCRA hazardous waste. A lot of people will have things like contaminated soils and sediments, and they'll say, oh, I've got to treat these to meet the RCRA LDRs, land disposal restriction treatment standards. And I say, wait a minute, back up. Are the contaminated sediments and the contaminated soil at your site defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, or must they be managed as a RCRA hazardous waste? If the sediments and soils are not defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, then the RCRA land disposal restrictions are not applicable. So that's really important. The LDRs only come into play if the waste you are managing is defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, or it's sediments, it's a media that contains a listed hazardous waste or exhibits a characteristic and therefore has to be managed as a RCRA hazardous waste. So that's an important take-home message, because we often get folks who will confuse the LDR standards, the treatment standards, and they immediately start looking at them and applying them to remediation wastes at their site without first making a determination whether those remediation wastes are in fact defined as RCRA hazardous wastes. So that's really important. If you do have a RCRA hazardous waste, then virtually all RCRA hazardous wastes are now subject to the Land Disposal Restrictions Program. The LDR program was phased in over a 15-20-year period, but if you generate a RCRA hazardous waste not at your site, you can assume that it is subject to the LDRs. Now, whether it's prohibited from land disposal or not is dependent on whether the waste meets applicable treatment standards. If it meets applicable treatment standards, which we'll talk about in the next slide, a couple of slides, then it's no longer prohibited from being land disposed. But if you have a hazardous waste that does not meet the treatment standards, then it is called a prohibited waste, and it's prohibited from being placed in a land disposal unit, okay, until it meets those treatment standards. Now let's discuss what the treatment standards are. The treatment standards are established in 40 CFR 268 subpart D. And if you generate a waste, a hazardous waste at your site, one of your obligations is to determine what the applicable treatment standards are and then determine whether or not the waste is prohibited from land disposal based on whether it meets or does not meet those treatment standards. Now, what Congress, when they wrote the amendments that created the LDR program, they defined a treatment standard as any method that reduces the mobility toxicity volume of a hazardous waste and essentially makes it safer for land disposal. I'm paraphrasing greatly there, but that's the idea. EPA, given that congressional definition and the regulations, they developed a program to establish treatment standards based on the performance of what we call best demonstrated available technology, or BDAT. And the treatment standards are expressed in several different ways. And if you looked in 40 CFR 268, 40, you'll see a table there. And within that table, it identifies first the RCRA waste code, and then as you move through the table, it will define what the treatment standard is. And the treatment standard will either be expressed as a concentration, okay, of a regulated constituent in that waste that's based on the performance of a treatment technology that was determined to be best demonstrated and applicable to that particular RCRA hazardous waste. Or in some case, the treatment standard will be expressed as a required technology. So you'll see some sort of acronym or abbreviation, okay, such as COMBST, combustion. Or you'll see something, another type of a term, again, you know, an abbreviation. And that's a reference to a required technology. Difference is where a treatment standard is expressed as a concentration of a regulated constituent, while that was established via a best demonstrated available technology, you can use any technology to achieve that treatment standard as long as it's not dilution. But where the treatment standard is expressed as as a required technology, then that's what you have to use. You have to use that method that's specified by the regulations. When you review the treatment standards and you're trying to identify an applicable treatment standard, you'll notice that the treatment standards are broken up first into what we call treatability groups. And there's two major treatability groups, wastewater, non-wastewater. I believe non-wastewater is defined, or the agency defines wastewater. It's in 268.1 or 268.2. But essentially, a wastewater is defined as something that's 99% water, 1% total organic carbon. Anything that's not a wastewater is a non-wastewater, vice versa. And so, in trying to identify the treatment standards, when you look at your waste stream, you have to physically know what your waste stream is, and you have to determine whether it's going to fit into the non-wastewater or wastewater treatability group, and therefore find the assigned treatment standard based on that particular group. Now, for some waste streams, the agency has developed what we call treatment subcategories. Mercury wastes are a prime example of this. Waste streams that exhibit the characteristic of toxicity for mercury. There are different treatment subcategories based on the concentration of mercury in the waste stream, and so you may have, again, various different treatment standards based on what treatability or treatment subcategory you fall into. So be aware of that as well. Now, our next slide, you'll see the first thing referenced is a universal treatment standard. This is really important. Universal treatment standards, the agency, when they first established treatment standards under the LDR program, they assigned treatment standards for each different RCRA hazardous waste, listed hazardous waste, and characteristic waste. And benzene, for example, is a regulated constituent in a number of different RCRA hazardous waste streams. So benzene can be identified in F005. It's a U waste. Benzene's in a number of different K-listed hazardous waste streams. And benzene's also a constituent that's identified in the toxicity characteristic. And EPA used to have different treatment standards for benzene depending on what waste code you assigned it to it. Well, they recognize the confusion, and they try to establish a consistent treatment standard for benzene, regardless of whether it's an F005 or U whatever or K, you know, 062 whatever. And this is what the universal treatment standards are. Universal treatment standards identify constituents; they're broken into their different treatability groups, and for the most part, doesn't care whether the benzene, one waste coat or not, or another, this is what the treatment standard for benzene is going to be. Now, the important thing about the universal treatment standards and where it comes into play with respect to the LDR program most often is it's an element in the treatment standards for characteristic hazardous wastes. And we talked about the four characteristics: ignitability, reactivity, corrosivity, and toxicity. Let's look at toxicity. Let's say you had a waste stream that exhibited the characteristic of toxicity for lead. So the TCLP level of the lead was above 5 milligrams per liter. That's what made it hazardous. But your soil also had arsenic in it and cadmium. But the arsenic and cadmium levels in that soil were below the TCLP levels, which are used to define as a hazardous waste. Okay, so the soil is only considered characteristic because it exhibits it's above the regulatory threshold for lead. Well, if you look at the treatment standard for the characteristic of your waste streams with the characteristic of toxicity, okay, you'll notice that you'll see something in there. It says meet a treatment standard for the lead, and then meet 268.48 standards. Okay, and what that indicates to you is that you will have to address treatment standards for any underlying hazardous constituents in that soil that exceed their universal treatment standards. So arsenic and cadmium in the scenario I'm discussing would be identified as underlying hazardous constituents. And while they don't cause the soil to exhibit the characteristic of toxicity, if the concentration of arsenic and cadmium were above their universal treatment standards, those constituents would still have to be treated to meet LDR standards along with the lead before that contaminated soil could be disposed of in a landfill. So that's important for you to understand, is that the universal treatment standards will apply to underlying hazardous constituents which need to be treated, for those ones which need to be treated in characteristic hazardous wastes. Just be aware of that. That's an important requirement, and that can affect your costs and your strategy for managing those types of waste streams. In addition, the agency has established alternative treatment standards for specific waste streams, lab packs. Okay, lab packs are commonly employed for the disposal of multiple chemicals. For example, if you're doing cleanups at laboratories where you have lots of small containers of reagents and commercial chemical products, and rather than try to dispose of individual quart and liter or even smaller size containers of those chemicals, you place them into one big drum in a lab pack. The agency, rather than trying to identify treatment standards for all those individual containers or commercial chemical products that are contained in that lab pack, you can avail yourself to an alternative treatment standard for a specific, that EPA has established for a lab pack in it itself, and use that, for purposes of complying with the LDR requirements. EPA has also established alternative treatment standards for things that are defined as hazardous debris. This would be like if you're doing cleanups at a site and you do you have a building that you have to demolish. For example, say they had a concrete floor and they used methylene chloride, as a solvent to remove paint, and the methylene chloride was spilled all over and permeated into the concrete. So the concrete was considered to be a RCRA hazardous waste if you were going to dispose of it. Well, the treatment standard for methylene chloride for non-wastewaters is based on combustion, and normally we don't like to combust big chunks of concrete. So what you would want to do is avail yourself to the alternative treatment standards for hazardous debris, because contaminated concrete, it's a listed hazardous waste or contains a listed hazardous waste, would be an example of something meeting the definition of hazardous debris. And there are various technologies that can, you know, could be applied to basically removing that superficial layer of methylene chloride from the concrete. Okay, pressure rinsing, there's a few other ones that are in there. But if you successfully applied those and met the cleanup standard, which is established in the regulations there, the alternative treatment standards for hazardous debris, then the residual concrete that you have, the clean concrete, can simply be disposed of as construction and debris waste, solid waste. And so that's, again, that's an important alternative treatment standard that's often used at CERCLA cleanups or RCRA corrective action authorized cleanups. There's also an alternative treatment standard for contaminated soils. And this, again, I don't have the time to go into it, but it avails you a more lenient treatment standard than the one that would be applied to either the characteristic or if the soil contained a listed waste, if you just use that specific listed waste applicable treatment standard. So if you have contaminated soil that's, again, defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, you may want to avail yourself to the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soils, because that provides you, again, with a more flexible, a less stringent, in some cases, not in all cases, standard to meet, rather than the specific treatment standard that's assigned to the waste code. So this next slide kind of walks you through how to determine a treatment standard, an LDR treatment standard, for a RCRA hazardous waste. First and most important step, determine that the waste that you're dealing with is in fact defined as a RCRA hazardous waste and identify the applicable RCRA hazardous waste code. F001, K062, D008. Once you've done that, then determine the waste treatability group. That's where you would look at 268.40. First thing you need to do is determine, okay, is my RCRA hazardous waste considered a non-wastewater or a wastewater? In some cases, there might be a subcategory. We were talking about mercury waste. So if your mercury level is above 260 milligrams per kilogram, there may be a specific treatment standard based on that level of mercury versus one that has less mercury content in it. Okay. If you have something like F001 through F005, those are the listings for spent solvents. There's about 30-some-odd solvent constituents that are listed in there. You just need to determine which constituents are regulated in the waste. And that goes back to the waste code that you assign it. So, for example, if you just had TCE, okay, that can be identified as waste code F002, say you had spent TCE solution that you were disposing of. Okay, then you would just need to, and you define that as RCRA hazardous waste F002, you'd only need to meet the LDR treatment standard for TCE, not all those other constituents that are in there, because they're not part of the waste stream. And then finally, if you have a characteristic hazardous waste, the treatment standard for characteristic hazardous waste may require you to identify underlying hazardous constituents in the waste. And so those would be constituents that do not cause the waste to exhibit that characteristic, but EPA has established universal treatment standards for those constituents. And if those constituents are above their universal treatment standard, then they must be treated as well as those constituents that cause the waste to exhibit the characteristic in the first place. So those are your basic steps. Once you have something that's a RCRA hazardous waste, that's how you go about determining what the applicable treatment standard is for that hazardous waste. Okay, we've already discussed briefly the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soils. As again, it provides you an option for meeting the LDR standards versus, again, more flexible than meeting the specific waste code treatment standards based on those waste codes that are applicable to that contaminated soil. As you can see, it provides a little more in that final statement there. The treatment standard requires that the concentrations of hazardous constituents be reduced by 90% from their maximum, and they're capped at 10 times the universal treatment standard. So they're somewhat less stringent than, again, the established treatment standards for specific RCRA waste codes. Okay. This measurement, it simply is that sometimes you'll see that the LDR treatment standards are either expressed as a total concentration versus a TCLP concentration. So where you see it referred, where the treatment standards like milligram per liter, TCLP, that simply means you have to use the TCLP test in order to determine whether that treatment standard's met. Oops, sorry. I mentioned earlier that the LDR requirements provide prohibitions against dilution and storage. These are statutory prohibitions that have been established in the regulations as well. Again, the idea with the dilution prohibition is you simply have a concentration-based treatment standard. You simply can't add dirt to it or engage in a treatment that would be defined as dilution in order to meet that treatment standard. If you're an active RCRA facility, regulated facility, there's a storage prohibition as well. And that's just so you, it allows you to store the waste for up to a year if it's subject to land disposal. But you have to ensure treatment before that time, or you're going to have to show proof to EPA or the state that you needed more than a year to find available treatment facility or treatment capacity to have your waste managed. But the idea there is just you're not allowed to store the waste as a means of avoiding compliance with the treatment standards. I mentioned earlier some of the variances. The treatability variance is the big one. No migration petitions are extremely rare. There's only been a couple of those that maybe a handful, two or three that have been approved. But the treatability variance is something you will encounter sometimes at CERCLA responses. And again, that's just where you've identified an applicable treatment standard. You realize that it's either too costly or it's not going to result, it's going to preclude active treatment of the waste as a result, so you can obtain a variance from that treatment standard, and that might that would result in a less stringent standard, and that may afford a reduced cost and therefore the ability to take treatment as a result. So treatability variances exist out there. They have been used at CERCLA sites before, and usually it's encountered where you have large volumes of waste that otherwise may not be treated because compliance with the LDR, with an established LDR treatment standard, would be too costly. Okay, this is just a little more on treatability variances. Just a few other things on TIPS is it's delegated now to the regional office. It used to have to be approved by headquarters. If you do use a treatability variance, this will have to be documented in your action memo or in your record of decision for those RPMs out there. And sometimes the RCRA program office will also have to issue a concurrence memorandum. And this will, you'll have to determine this within your regions if this is applicable or not. Okay, Gene, I'll take a quick break. And see if there's any questions on LDRs. I know I went through that quickly, but if there's a couple of quick questions on it, I'd be happy to try to address them for you in the time we have.
Sure. We did have two questions that came in, and for those of you who are online still, you can keep typing up questions and comments, and we'll continue to take these breaks here and there. But our first question comes in from a participant that asks, are beveled materials excluded from LDR?
What type of materials? I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
I might be mispronouncing it. It's B-E-V-E-L-L-E-D. beveled?
Beveled. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. You're talking about like a bevel exclusion. If I'm understanding the question, is bevel material subject to the LDR? No. If you have a waste that has been excluded, a solid waste that's been excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. So, for example, you have a mineral processing beneficiation waste, which is covered by the Bevel Amendment. It was a statutory amendment to the original RCRA, which excluded certain waste streams. And EPA has made a regulatory determination what's covered by Bevel and what's not. It's in 261.4B7, I believe. The waste is excluded from the definition of hazardous waste. LDRs don't apply to it. So if something's covered by the Bevel exclusion, then that waste stream is not subject to LDRs. LDRs are not applicable. Okay, genius.
Yep. I think that I got it. And then our next question asks about the subject of surficial concrete. Could you be able to speak about PCB impregnated concrete in terms of the alternative or alternate treatment category?
Okay, well, PCBs in and of themselves are not regulated as RCRA hazardous waste. So the assumption would have to be whether or not you had a situation where maybe it was PCBs and methylene chloride. You would have to have something else, some other constituent, that was impregnated in the concrete that rendered it a RCRA hazardous waste. If it were PCBs in and of itself, that's not subject to RCRA regulation. That would be, you know, the concrete and how it would have to be managed and decontaminated would all be governed by TSCA regulations.
Okay. Great. I think that's the end. We're getting some statements that, yes, that's correct. They're talking about TSCA.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we can go ahead and continue on. We have about 10 or so minutes left in our scheduled time.
Okay. Just want to briefly go through a few on-site, off-site management. This is where RCRA is an ARAR at your cleanups. And I just want to talk real briefly about some RCRA requirements or policies that apply to on-site management of hazardous waste and hazardous remediation waste. And then we'll conclude with a brief discussion of when you're sending a RCRA hazardous waste off-site, what are some of the requirements that RCRA establishes for when the wastes go off-site. And on-site and off-site, In the CERCLA world, you have some latitude as how you define your site. And for those of you who do deal with mining sites out there in the west or even here in the east, eastern part of the United States, some of your sites can be very, very, very large. Okay, so under CERCLA, site is kind of defined based on the definitions of the facility and release, where the release has occurred and where the contaminants have spread. When we talk about, there's a different definition of on-site and off-site for purposes of RCRA, and that's attributed to RCRA-regulated facilities. But basically the concept here would be is if you're sending waste off-site to a commercial vendor for disposal, what are the RCRA regulations that are going to apply to that off-site shipment into that facility? So we'll talk a little bit more about those in just a few minutes. But let's talk about some RCRA ARARs with respect to on-site management. It's often you'll use containers. Containers are actually a defined term under RCRA, and they include something that's portable. Okay, so that'd be like a roll-off box, or dumpster, or the 55-gallon drum. Actually, tank cars, railroad tank cars defined as a container, assuming you haven't taken the wheels off of it, made it immobile, okay? But there are regulatory requirements for containers that are pretty straightforward. Containers have to be in good condition, compatible with the waste, closed during storage, and provided with secondary containment. There's also some regulations if you're managing ignitable, reactive, and incompatible waste. And these are just with ignitable and reactive waste, there are some setback requirements that the waste have to be managed at least I believe, 50 feet or more from the property line. You cannot have incompatible waste placed in the same container, obviously, but they can also be placed in close proximity, where if there was a leak, incompatible waste could mingle and cause an explosion or fire. So if you have incompatible waste, they have to be segregated by space or by divider. And then if you do have a container storage area, when you go are done with it, there's a requirement under RCRA that you basically close it in a proper manner. So residues, remaining containers, liners, bases, and any contaminated soil that may have resulted from the storage of containers in that area need to be decontaminated or removed when you're through with that area and that space. Now, a temporary unit is a specific remediation waste management unit. It was created a number of years ago, back in the mid-1990s, under the RCRA Corrective Action Program. But it's an ARR in the CERCLA world, so it's often used in CERCLA. And it's basically a container or tank that's used to manage remediation wastes. One of the reasons why temporary unit is really popular in the CERCLA world is that the RCRA regulations for hazardous waste tank systems are pretty detailed and pretty stringent. They involve rather stringent requirements for leak detection, leak monitoring, integrity assessments, a number of other requirements that don't apply to a temporary unit. So oftentimes, if you're going to use a tank-type system to manage RCRA hazardous waste at a CERCLA site, you want to avail yourself, you want to call it a temporary unit and comply with the regulations for temporary units, because this provides you flexibility to what standards you have to meet. The only thing is there's a limit in terms of how long they can temporary units can be operated. I believe it's 1 year, but you can get it renewed for another year. But this, again, if you're using a tank system for treating or storing hazardous wastes, remediation wastes at a CERCLA site, or even RCRA corrective action, you'd like to avail yourself to the ARRs for temporary units rather than RCRA hazardous waste tank systems. Okay. Oops, skip. The area of contamination concept, just a couple of seconds on this. This is an important concept, but what this came about, the idea behind it is if you've had a source and a release from that source that's contaminated the soil, okay, that area of contamination caused by that release, for example, say you had a container storage area, you had a bunch of drums, and they leaked, and the leakage contaminated soil, you know, for about like maybe a 20-foot area around there, or maybe more. That area of contaminated soil is considered a discrete unit. And what the idea behind that is say you had to dig some soil up from one side of the contaminated area and you wanted to move it over to the other. If that contaminated soil were considered a hazardous waste, if you were to pick it up and put it back down on the ground again, you would actually trigger the LDRs, Land Disposal Restrictions Regulations. Because remember, the LDRs prohibit you from placing a RCRA hazardous waste that does not meet the treatment standards on the land or in land disposal. The idea behind the AOC is basically this, is if you have an area of contamination associated with a source, it's considered as if it were like a landfill. And so if you move soil within the area of contamination, just pick it up, move it around, and consolidate it, you're not going to trigger compliance with the RCRA land disposal restrictions or the RCRA minimum technology requirements. The minimum technology requirements are basically liners and leachate collection systems, which are mandatory for any hazardous waste land disposal unit, like a landfill waste pile, for example. The important thing with AOCs is it's a concept that's only applicable to remediation wastes. And one of the big things you have to remember is if you define separate AOCs at your site. So say you have one source, say an old landfill where you have contaminated soil, say in the northwest corner of the site, and then you have a bunch of clean area, and you have another source on the southeast corner where they buried maybe some drums, and there's some contaminated soil there. So you define two separate AOCs. You cannot take, under this policy, contaminated soil from one AOC and move it into a separate AOC. If you did that, you would trigger compliance with the LDR requirements. So your ability to consolidate or move contaminated soil within the AOC is restricted to that AOC. You can't transfer contaminated soil from one AOC to another without triggering the RCRA LDRs and minimum technological requirements. A corrective action management unit, again, is a special type of land-based unit created for management of remediation waste. This is typically used where you have a high volume, a large volume of hazardous waste where it's cost prohibitive to send that waste off-site for disposal. So some I know where it's been used a couple of times are some of the steel mill sites up around Lake Michigan near Gary, Indiana, where they've created some large corrective action management units on site, some of the old U.S. steel facilities, to manage a lot of tailings and other waste, contaminated soils that were generated during the cleanup response at those sites. CAMUs, there are different types of CAMUs. You can have treatment CAMUs, you can have a temporary CAMU, you can have a disposal CAMU. Depending on the type of CAMU you're going to create, there's liner requirements, caps, if it's going to be a disposal unit. If it's, again, a disposal unit, there's a requirement for corrective action for any future releases. CAMUs, waste that are placed in the CAMUs are subject to the LDRs, but the LDR requirements only apply, require treatment of what is defined as a principal hazardous constituent. So the CAMUs don't get you completely out of the LDR requirements. CAMUs can be placed where you have contamination. They can also be sited in clean areas. In some cases, they can even be sited at areas that are not on your site but are nearby. CAMUs do require designation in your action memo or a ROD. But again, they are used for managing large volumes of remediation waste. And they do provide some flexibility to the design requirements that would otherwise apply to a RCRA hazardous waste landfill.
I just wanted to pop in here and just do a real quick time check. We have come up to 3 p.m. Eastern, so just wanted to let our participants know we're going to stay on the line and take about another 5 to 8 minutes to try to get through the remaining materials and any closeout questions. We appreciate everybody's patience. If you could hang on again for just another 5 to 8 minutes. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah, we're just about done here. So just a couple other things here on the differences between an AOC and a CAMU. CAMUs can be located in uncontaminated areas. Obviously, an AOC cannot. The other good thing about CAMUs is you can take your remediation waste from areas, any AOC or any area that's not contiguously contaminated, the site and place it in a CAMU. So you don't have that restriction within the movement of materials between AOCs when you're placing the wastes or placing contaminated soils in CAMUs. So that's an important distinction between that. Staging pile is another common unit that's cited and it's used for managing remediation waste, the CERCLA and RCRA corrective action cleanups. Staging piles allow you basically to place waste on the ground without complying with the LDRs and MTR and minimum technological requirements. The only thing is you're not allowed to treat waste in the staging pile. Okay, it's for what it says, basically short-term storage. You can do certain sorts of mixing, sizing, blending, or other physical operations, but you can't actually engage in treatment. And you have flexibility in terms of the design requirements for liner systems, containment, run-on, run-off controls. So staging piles, again, is commonly employed as an alternative to the RCRA hazardous waste pile regulations for managing, again, large volumes of contaminated materials that are defined as RCRA hazardous waste at CERCLA and RCRA cleanup responses, authorized responses. This final policy here deals with reinjection of contaminated groundwater during cleanups. The concept here is there was a statutory provision added to RCRA, Section 3020, and the idea here is, as I mentioned, underground injection is considered a form of land disposal. So if you had a situation where you had a contaminated plume, which was defined as a RCRA hazardous waste, so the groundwater, when you extracted it, that groundwater would be considered to contain a RCRA hazardous waste. Well, in theory, you would be prohibited under the LDRs from reinjecting it unless you met the LDR treatment standards. EPA recognizes this is a problem with pump and treat groundwater restoration systems, and so they sought, the Congress to basically exclude, from the land disposal restrictions, active pump and treat programs, that are restoring contaminated groundwater that's defined as RCRA hazardous waste from the land disposal, from the LDR treatment standards. And so that's the purpose behind 3020. One of the other issues, this is also, there's an EPA corresponding EPA policy and guidance that explains how this works. One of the other areas is if you have like an in-situ treatment where you're doing some sort of biologic remediation or you're adding ingredients and you're treating sources in the there as well. Again, when you extract that contaminated groundwater and reinject it, you're not going to be subject to the LDR prohibitions that would otherwise apply, provided that, again, the cleanup is authorized under RCRA corrective action or a CERCLA authorized response. So that's the basic concept, is that, again, in groundwater restoration programs where you reinjected contaminated groundwater, it's defined as RCRA hazardous waste. This provision and corresponding guidance and policy can exclude you from complying with the LDR regulations. Okay, the other thing that might apply are closure and post-closure care requirements. If you had a facility that you're cleaning up that was once subject to RCRA and had units on site, say like a surface impoundment or a waste pile or a container storage area or a tank system, and those were permitted under RCRA before the facility became subject to a CERCLA response, the RCRA closure standards for those units would be ARARs. And so you just need to be aware of what those RCRA closure requirements are and ensure that your response action addresses and meets those RCRA requirements. And if you had, a landfill that you were going to close with waste in place, the RCRA post-closure care regulations, which are basically maintenance, monitoring, groundwater monitoring requirements, those are applicable regulations that would apply to that unit. And so those would have to be addressed in your response. Yeah, the final thing here, then I'll remain online for a few minutes for any questions that you all have, are when waste are being sent off-site, these are your major RCRA regulations that you need to be aware of. So you're sending RCRA hazardous waste off-site to a disposal facility or treatment facility. First thing is RCRA requires that any containers that you're sending off-site be marked, labeled, managed in compliance with Department of Transportation hazardous material regulations. So that would mean that the drums have to have the appropriate labels and markings on them. You have to, the truck transport vehicle would have to be placarded properly. You have to use, you have to comply with packaging requirements that DOT has established under the Hazardous Materials Transportation Act regulations. The second thing is RCRA hazardous waste, they're being sent off-site, require the use of the RCRA hazardous waste manifest. That's now one uniform manifest that's used throughout the country, which has to be attached to each shipment when it's of hazardous waste off-site. To use the manifest, you'll need an EPA identification number. So if your site does not have an EPA identification number, again, and you're going to be sending RCRA hazardous waste off-site, you'll have to apply and obtain an EPA ID number as a generator for the site. As a generator, you'll use that on your hazardous waste manifest. The transporter must also have an EPA ID number, and your designated facility, disposal facility, is required to have an EPA ID number as well. As well as any facility that's going to receive hazardous waste off-site has to have a RCRA permit, and so they'll have to be permitted to accept that particular waste stream as well. With respect to LDRs, I mentioned that you'll have to notify the subsequent handler, at least on the initial shipment for that particular waste, that you'll have to make a determination whether the waste is prohibited from land disposal or not, and that's based on whether or not identifying what the treatment standards are for that waste and whether the waste meets that treatment standard or not. Again, that information has to be provided to the next subsequent handler. The LDR regulations specify that you send that notice, and you also have to certify as well to the accuracy of the information provided in a notice that's attached to the initial manifest for every waste that's sent off-site. Provided that the waste doesn't change and the vendor that you're using doesn't change, the disposal company who's receiving the waste, then you only have to attach that LDR notice one time. But if you the waste changes or use a different vendor, then you'll have to reinitiate that LDR notice and attach it to the first manifest shipment of waste that that you send off-site. And then the final thing are biennial reports. This is always an interesting topic, especially with the OSCs. But what I'm going to say about this is there's a RCRA regulation, okay, that's triggered based on you shipping hazardous waste off-site. If you ship more than 1,000 kilograms of hazardous waste off-site, you are defined as a large quantity generator. And as a result of doing that, okay, the following year, okay, you have to prepare a biennial report or an annual report, okay, as a result of shipping, of being a large quantity generator and shipping this off. EPA requires a biennial report. Some states actually require an annual report. Headquarters considers this to be an applicable requirement, okay, for off-site shipments, where, again, you meet the criteria. You would be a large quantity generator, so you'd have to be shipping at least 1,000 kilograms of hazardous waste off-site in a calendar month. So just be aware of that, that there you may have to do a biennial report the following year or an annual report. Depends on the state. The state has a more stringent requirement. And that's associated with off-site shipments of RCRA-regulated hazardous waste. Okay, folks, that's pretty much it. I appreciate you listening to me for 2 hours. That's a lot of RCRA. Hopefully you all had some good caffeinated beverages there to keep you awake, and you got some good take-home messages on that. Gene, if there's any, you know, a few remaning questions out there, I don't know how much time you can allow us to continue.
Sure.
I'm happy to answer those for a few minutes.
We can stay on the line for another moment or so. I don't see any additional questions in the online queue, but we will hang on for just a minute or so to see if there are any outstanding comments or questions. While we're waiting, for those of you that might be typing up any final comments, I'm going to provide some final statements before we close things out, including how you can provide feedback for today's seminar, how you can access the resources that were discussed, including the slides that were used, as well as sign up for other seminars in the OSC Presents or CEC for OSC's training series on CLUIN, and then again, how you can submit feedback to try to verify your participation today. So again, I don't see anything else hopping in on the queue, but if you're still typing, that's okay. I do have those final closing reminders. So I'll go ahead and start to go through those just to see if there are any other final statements. We'll give you guys another second. Sure, go ahead.
I was just going to say, for any of you folks out there, I know that there was the one question about, you know, the preamble language regarding determining whether at a CERCLA site whether something's a listed waste or not. I believe you guys have my emails. If you shoot me an email afterwards, you know, I'll find that for you and respond to you as well. Or if there's any other couple of questions that may have that this period of time you don't have time to address, but you want to shoot me an email, I'll be happy to take a look at that as well and address them as I can.
Okay, great. And I'm going to share the URL where people can find the presenter contact information, including your email address. I'm going to pass that off as a URL to everybody. While we're waiting to see if there are any final statements or questions, again, you can choose to engage with us on the CLUIN website by visiting us, signing up for some of our free newsletters like Tech Direct. We also have popular social and professional networking services. We're on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter if you want to learn about the latest and greatest CLUIN resources like training like this. You're certainly welcome to follow us and engage with us there. Again, it looks like, we got another question that came in reference to slide number 32. Okay. One of our participants would like you to go back to slide number 32 and try to explain the following quote, capped at 10 times the UTF. Can you please explain that further?
Yeah, okay. Real quickly, if you look at the treatment standard for alternative contaminated soils, as I mentioned earlier, they're less stringent than what would otherwise apply to, the specific RIC or waste code that you have. So if you had the best way to explain it is by giving you an example. If you had contaminated soil that exhibited the characteristic of toxicity for lead, and you also have one other constituent in there, say arsenic, you'd have to, the alternative treatment standards for contaminated soil provide you with two different kind of options there. You can reduce the concentration of lead, the maximum amount of lead, by 90%. And if your treatment would result, say you had 500, milligrams per kilogram, or 500 milligrams per liter, lead was the maximum concentration in your contaminated soil. Then, if you reduce that by 90%, so that would take you down to 50 or 100. You would meet the treatment standard there. Your treatment would never have to go. And now if you didn't use the 90% reduction, if you only had maybe 20 milligrams per liter of lead, that's still above the treatment standard. You would, the universal treatment standard for lead, you would only have to meet 10 times the universal treatment standard for lead instead of the actual UTS number. So your treatment would only have to go to 10 times the UTS and not below that. So that's the idea that the agency was getting behind, is that for alternative contaminated soils, you could achieve the LDR treatment standard by a 90% reduction in the regulated constituent from its maximum level, okay? Or you could treat, if that's not appropriate, okay, or not applicable in your case, then you would treat down to no more than 10 times the universal treatment standard for that particular constituent. So hopefully that kind of clarifies your question.
Thank you. Thank you so very much, Steve. I think we'll go ahead and close out the online question portion, but as you said, if anyone does have any follow-on questions or they find themselves in their day-to-day activities as an OSC and they do have a question related to today's topic, we have shared the seminar homepage where you can find the contact information for Dave Phillips from Tetra Tech. You can certainly drop him an email in relation to today's topic. I also want to echo Dave's thanks. I want to thank, first of all, Dave for joining us and delivering this entire session on his own. He did a great job. I also want to thank the 67 individuals who joined us from all over the country. Again, a collection of OSCs, both working in the office as well as in the field. We appreciate you guys taking time out of your busy day for today's session. If you'd like to download a copy of the presentation materials, you'll find that on the resources or links page. That's also available under the related URLs window. You can actually click on seminar resources, press the browse to button, and that'll open up a website where you can download a copy of the presentation slides. We'd ask if you could take just a moment to fill out a short feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's broadcast. That's also available under related URLs, and I also sent it out to everyone in the Q&A window. It just takes a second. Let us know what you thought of today's broadcast. And if you're looking for verification of your participation today, we don't necessarily issue training certificates through CLUIN, but if you fill out the feedback form, there's a box you can check to send a confirmation email to you, which will at least verify when you submitted feedback and confirm that it was after the live delivery. So if you keep that email along with your registration email and a copy of the slides or a printout of the seminar homepage, you should be able to earn credit and at least verify your attendance in today's session. We do also have new ways to look up your training record on the CLUIN website, and if you need any help with that, feel free to drop me an email at balance.gene@epa.gov. If you shared the line with multiple participants, each one of you can actually fill out your own feedback form and get your own seminar feedback verification email for your own records. Again, today's broadcast was recorded and will automatically be made available for free replay and download on the CLUIN archive page. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks. And for those of you that signed up, you'll also get an email automatically once that archive is available. If you're one of the lucky ones who's watching that recorded version right now, you guys can actually go through and still submit feedback just by replaying the archive and following the links to the feedback form. And you can also earn credit for replaying an archive session. So a great big thanks to those of you who joined us for today's broadcast. The next seminar in the series for CEC training for OSCs was previously scheduled for October 2nd, but pending potential government shutdown or scheduling conflicts, we will be rescheduling that seminar for October 16th. There will be additional information sent to all of the registrants for the current delivery, which is going to look at the pipeline for OSCs, and we'll send you more details on that reschedule notice. So we just appreciate everybody's patience as we work to kind of schedule around some potential conflicting dates with the potential government shutdown on October 1st. So again, thank you all so very much for joining us. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure every day, and that we'll either see you or hear from you on a future CLUIN.